I have a different kind of prelude for this, our last session together with you. It is a Jim Carroll poem, but it is a different kind of prelude. It's not really poetry time. It's more personal than the other preludes. I guess it's something that Mary and I wished to share with you, maybe should have done it the first time that we were together. And the reason that I'm using Jim and a poem to share it with you is because I'm too bashful to do it in my own words. My first desperation was for a secret of my own, to tell or not, a precious mortar between me and other boys beneath the bridge behind the school. Gang, I said at last, I have a real secret, my very own, for you. What? What? They cried, then laughed when I lied that I could fly. But we all believed. Such is the need of nine, nearly ten, and when I beat my arms and slowly left the dirt, lifting past the bridge, waving by the windows of the school, teachers passing out, cruising high the town and flying indeed away forever from the boys and from boyhood, it is well known now that I can fly. They all admire me, but the first desperation for a secret of my own clings like time. Now I have only your ear for this last chance at mixing precious mortar, this last only secret of my very own, just for you. I cannot fly at all. We've raised some questions about things that make for peace. And if you're going to have the people that have the answers to those questions, it's going to be in further faculty, not this week. This is our last session on things that make for peace and is a last way of giving another biblical consciousness, another way of seeing. And really, I have only an introduction, and Mary has the bulk of this global consciousness. In the book, it's fat sheep, lean sheep. Has to do with living in the midst of a hungry world and those things. So let me just share with you a couple things about a biblical way of seeing that seem to me appropriate for today. First of all, it would be a global vision. We've had clues to this, hints of this along during the week. We said that shalom in the Old Testament had an interconnectedness, that when the biblical concept of peace was expressed, it had an interrelatedness about all of God's creation, not only between or among people, but between the created earth, the things that are here, and we who inhabit this earth as stewards. So a biblical way of seeing when you start talking about global justice is that there is a global vision, a way of looking beyond my kind of people, if you remember the Clarence Jordan tape. A Pentecost language that ends the languages of Babel. Also, I think a biblical way of viewing today would include how the Bible views the whole matter of hunger. There's going to be some detailed description today of the hunger situation, and by and large, when we begin looking at it, we will see it as the hunger problem. But biblically, when you begin, hunger is not, first of all, a problem. It's, first of all, a sacramental, Eucharistic communion, the kingdom pictured as a banquet, as a feast, Jesus as the bread of life, a Lord who was known to his disciples in the breaking of bread. First of all, hunger is part of our creatureliness and therefore part of our dependence upon a provident Father, a provident God who supplies our needs. So the first biblical view of hunger is to see it sacramentally. Secondly, if you view hunger biblically, I think you see in the scriptures that God gives enough to feed all. That as we view today the world hunger problem, let's make sure we understand that it's not a food problem, it's a poverty problem. There is enough in the world today. I think you can quote pretty good experts that we might be able to feed 8 billion people, but it is a distribution problem. It is an economic problem, and it is a poverty problem. Also, as you take a biblical view of hunger, When God's people saw hunger, what they saw was a chance to share their bread. We started, I think, the very first day with a bumper sticker that was on a car ahead of us, "Let the bastards freeze in the dark." Sometimes when people view world hunger as a problem, they have views such as tough breaks. They shouldn't live in the section where the Sahara Desert is moving 50 miles a year. That's too bad. Or to view hunger as a problem, saying it's their overpopulation, it's their underdevelopment. The view of hunger biblically, however, is a chance for those who have to share their bread. And the final thing that I was going to say about a biblical view of hunger is that when you see it in the scriptures, it's often a call to God's people for voluntary restraints. That God's people voluntarily limited themselves and lived within the limits so that that providence of God was not unequally distributed. All of those things are part of a biblical view. So as you listen today to some of the things that are part of the realism of today's world, and I'm not trying to take away any of the sharpness from that, because I think that's part of the reality, and Eliul is right, we're probably short on realism more than on good intentions, but that biblically you see it as a provident God supplying enough for his people, and that one of the things that we are called to is a chance to share. So the final introduction is another poem that it seems to me gives this biblical view. It's called "The Lord's is the Earth." It's our psalm for this afternoon. Jim Carroll takes a little freedom with it, but I think is consistent with the psalm. "The Lord's is the earth, and the fullness thereof." Perhaps. "I do know it's not mine." How do we presume to claim for ourselves or for our children dirt that leaves labor over, or the low hill that is an ancient broken-hearted mountain worn away by long erosion, white tides of snow? Who owns the rivers unseen that run in the bowels of earth, that lubricate the turning of the axis of the world? Getty? Gulf? Humble? Humble. When I was a child, dirt and dry leaves were my first friends. I sat with them bouncing, talking, before I knew what playing was. I remember the summer day when the lady yelled at me, shoved me from her yard, and from her dirt, and from her dry leaves. Something wrong was done that day, but I thought I had done it. And I ran away in my shame, with fear that was new, having learned my first lesson in who really owns the earth. You can say the Lord's is the earth if you want to, but let him try to picnic where it's posted. Who owns the earth? Getty? Gulf? Humble? Humble. And that mean lady of my early flight and shame? The firmament of stability, the foundation of the universe and source of all fertility, the womb, the tomb, the green planet, we learn to think of it as property or real estate if it's for sale. If we have awakened to the earth, we may be in trouble because it belongs to someone else. We may use the sidewalk and the street and those scabs of concrete assigned to playing, but if we exult in harvest now, we are trespassing, and the mean lady this time may have a gun. If we allow the soil to stir our souls, we may be changed. We may learn what we knew once, that the dirt and dry leaves own us. It was people very like you and me who first cried, "The Lord's is the earth and the fullness thereof," and they were probably trying to say more about each other than God. To say the land is the Lord's is not to say he's the landlord. The earth and its children know. The old men and women who own nothing, the defeated, the sharecroppers, the starving, the peasants who have to trespass everywhere. The Lord's is the earth, and it is full enough for everyone. It waits for us to learn that again.
I'd like to begin by reading a quote from Coleman McCarthy, a columnist wrote in the Washington Post History has never seen a country collectively decide to sacrifice its standard of living for the goal of relieving the suffering of another country. If anything, as in war, it's always the opposite. Citizens will sacrifice for the purpose of increasing the misery of other tribes. So, in this sense, there is a war on, with people dying of hunger as painfully as though bombs or napalm fell on them. And this war appears to have few protesters in America. The few people who see a moral link between their own plentiful food supply and the non-supply of the hungry. I guess what I want to talk about today as far as relates to hunger is that until we see hunger as a family problem, I really don't think we're going to be affected by it much or do much about it. I think all of us as children probably thought of our family as, you know, mom and dad and brothers and sisters and maybe some aunts and uncles or grandparents if you had a little bit of an extended family. And I really have to share with you how I begin to see family as much bigger than those that I love very much around our own dining room table. And this came to me when we moved into the District of Columbia. And at Thanksgiving time, our small congregation decided that we would take our baskets of food over to the Church of the Pilgrims, which was a large Presbyterian church in our neighborhood. We didn't have a church building. We would take our Thanksgiving dinners over there and set up the tables and spread them with our best white tablecloths, and we carried goblets and crystal and sterling and all these little Thanksgiving candles that have pilgrims and turkeys and that you never light but you always put on year after year, and a nice flower arrangement, and we set the table just as if we were in our own home. But the week before, we had mimeographed invitations to people in the neighborhood and put them up in the roomy houses and apartment buildings and tacked them to the door or to the trees on DuPont Circle and stuck them on benches. And the invitation simply said, if anybody is hungry or lonely or has no place to go or no one to share the Thanksgiving dinner with, you'd be more than welcome to join us at the Church of the Pilgrims at 1 o'clock on Thanksgiving. So about 15 of us family units would go over and we'd sit and wait to see who appeared to share our Thanksgiving with us. And it was always an eye-opener because there were runaway kids from the suburbs that congregated around DuPont Circle, kids really hung up on drugs, alcoholics, winos that just, you know, kind of sauntered in a couple of hours before the meal started. One time we had a mother who was on public assistance who brought her four children and sat there eating with tears in her eyes and said, you know, we have never had a Thanksgiving dinner like this. And I always have to say that our kids really started to resent Thanksgiving dinners at the Church of the Pilgrims. You know, why can't we be home and eat with our relatives like every other normal family? And especially the year that a wino came and sat at our table and lit all those little turkeys and pilgrims. The kids had not been allowed to do that in all the years that we'd been traditionally putting them back on our table, and here he sat and we weren't supposed to say anything as we watched the pilgrims burning down to the quick. But that whole experience, I imagine we did this 4 or 5 years in a row, I really started to see that here were people in my global family who were suffering in some way. And it's very easy to be aware of these people when they actually come and sit at your table. None of us are going to say, you know, go away, wino, go away, runaway kid, go away, kid, you're so hung up on drugs that you don't even know what's going on. Because they have a need and we were glad to share. And so I wonder, well, I don't wonder, I think I know that when they're out of sight, they're out of mind. I think television has done a lot to bring the hunger problem before us because we see people dying in India and people stepping over these people that are dying in the street and they're kind of falling in the gutters and nobody seems to be paying any attention. And you think, you know, how could you see that and not do anything? And yet I find myself with the same blindness again, not being able to see because those people aren't.
The power went off here. We will insert a small segment from a battery-operated tape recorder.
And maybe two of those people at the table actually had food to eat like we enjoy. I don't think any of us would turn these people away, and that is literally what the table of the world looks like, but we fail to realize it. I think when we've begun to lose our love for God or our faith, we also begin to lose our love of others,
and our love of our environment and the soil. And I think maybe that's what's at the basis of it. There's a lot of selfishness and greed that screams out defect. I know that you've heard a lot of statistics about hunger, but just let me refresh your mind a little bit. That as we talk, and when we go to sit down to our meal tonight, or as we ate our bowl of barley, 30,000 people somewhere in the world died of hunger. And of the 60 million deaths that are reported each year, a third of those deaths are due directly to hunger or malnutrition causes. That two-thirds of the people in the world tonight will go to bed hungry, and a half of those will be children. And that half of the children in the world will die before they're 5 years old, mainly because of hunger problems. That only 20% of the world's population gets the adequate amount of protein and minerals that they need. And if you think you have to go very far away, there are something like 30 million people in the United States that don't get adequate diets. Now granted, they're not the poverty kind of people that you see in South America and Bangladesh and India and parts of Africa. But 30 million people who either don't have the education or the knowledge as to how they can get food stamps, or maybe they have been malnourished as children and don't have the mental capacity to do the things that are necessary in this country. You find them in migrant camps, on Indian reservations, where they have the highest infant mortality rate of any place in the world. You find them in the ghettos. You find them in apartments in the city where there are old people. 3 million old people over 60 are confined to their homes and not able to cook for themselves, so they have to rely on relatives or Meals on Wheels programs or a neighbor who happens to come in and give them something to eat. Old people that are afraid to walk out on the street because they're going to get mugged. And we saw them in the District of Columbia, and I don't think D.C. is anything like the areas in Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, New York, and so forth. 17% of the people in the United States have an income that is below the poverty level of $5,500 a year. So we don't have to go too far to know that there is a hunger problem. Now, I don't know what it's like to be hungry. You know, I try fasting, and I have a very difficult time with it because I'm not a very disciplined person. And I don't know if any of you have really been honestly hungry, but let me read to you from the diary of a Brazilian slum dweller. Her name is Carolina Maria de Jesus, and she has a book called Child of the Dark. It's her diary. And this is how she describes what it's like to be hungry. The days of hunger, that's D-A-Z-E, the days of hunger is worse than that of alcohol. The days of alcohol makes one sing, but the days of hunger makes me shake.
I cannot tell you how horrible it is to have only air in the stomach. I begin to have a bitter taste in my mouth. I thought, is there no end to the bitterness of life? From the papers that I collected today, I got 6 coins. I wanted to save them to buy beans, but I couldn't because my stomach was screaming and torturing me. I decided to do something about it, so I brought a bread roll. Oh, what a surprising effect food has on one. Before I ate, I saw the sky and the trees and the birds all yellow. But after I ate, everything was normal to my eyes again. Food in the stomach is like fuel in a machine. I was able to work better. My whole body stopped weighing me down. I started to walk faster, and I had the feeling that I was gliding in space. I started to smile as if I were witnessing a beautiful drama. Will there ever be a drama more beautiful than that of eating? And another place in her diary, she says, do you know how I felt when my child said to me, Mama, please sell me to Donna Juanita. She has such delicious food. And, you know, I find this very difficult to understand how a child could be crying. I think of Marin sometimes, you know, when she cries and cries. What if Sharon wasn't able to nurse her? What if she just cried all the time? Not being able to give your child the milk that they need or desire, I can't imagine that. And I think it's Carol Hinderly that uses the example of, why can't we be like these African tribes that when one member of the tribe is sick, they take the person to the medicine man or to the doctor and they say, we are sick, you know, please heal us. And I think that's a very beautiful image, a way of seeing that when one person in my family suffers, when one member of the body of Christ suffers, we all suffer. And I think until we get this new vision, this new way of seeing that this is my family, I'm not going to be willing to do anything about it. All right, hunger isn't an easy problem. And I would be the most naive person in the world to say that, you know, there's just a few easy reasons why people are hungry and therefore a few handy-dandy ways that you can alleviate the problem. But let's just review a little bit again some of the problems that cause hunger, and maybe you can see how you can fit into some of these. Obviously, weather has a lot to do with hunger. When we have droughts and monsoons, and the Sahara Desert is encroaching at the rate of 50 miles a year, these all cause very serious problems. There's not a lot we can do about the weather. I think one really neat thing I heard was some Middle East country that with one of the oil-producing countries that was paying $5 million to have some tugboats bring an iceberg down and put it on their country and let it melt and help irrigate. I think that's a very nice thing to do with our oil dollars. Overpopulation is another reason, and that's usually what people first say. Oh, it's because there are too many people over there. Why don't they stop having babies? Then they could, you know, it really isn't our problem. America is now just about down to zero population growth, or I think we are, but there are still many countries. India is a good example. The average couple in India has 12 kids, six. The reason they do this is because they know that four of these children are going to die before they reach the age of five. And in India, if you don't have any land to farm, if you don't have a way of earning a living, you rely on your children to beg. And who's going to take care of the parents in their old age? So they have large families, because at least two children will survive to help the parents in their older age and to help them beg and scrounge up enough food for the four of them to eat. And they've proven through test cases that they've taken villages in India and brought the standard of living up, given them adequate housing, food, education, medical supplies. The birth rate drops dramatically, because when there is a security and a sense of knowing that I don't have to have so many children because the ones I do have are going to survive, the birth rate drops. So I think it's a very vicious circle. And I think until there is some sort of stability, we're not going to be able to knock the birth control or the overpopulation problem. Underdevelopment is another reason. There are areas or groups working on the development of third and fourth world nations. Again, I never felt that there was a lot I could do except maybe some political lobbying to help the underdevelopment. Countries that just cultivate one crop because it makes for a good export product, like coffee is a good example of this. Probably one of the best reasons that we have, or the most prevalent reason for hunger in the world, are unjust economic structures. And I'd just like to mention a few of these, because I've been reading some papers that the United Nations has put out, and it really kind of helped me to see the problem a little bit clearer. Russia is a very wealthy nation, so they can afford to buy grain. And in 1972, when they had a very lousy grain crop, they came to the United States in those secret little grain deals that now many people are regretting, and they bought our surplus of grain because they were wealthy and could afford to do this. When the surplus of our grain dropped, the price tripled. At the same time period, India and Bangladesh had those terrible monsoons, and they wiped out any crops that they had, and so here were a lot of hungry people. They came to the United States and said, we'd like to buy your surplus grain. We said, we're sorry, the Russians have already purchased it, and besides, our price is three times what it was last year, and the Indian government could not afford to buy even what little we did have left. So that's an economic factor. If you're wealthy, you can afford to buy just about anything you want. If you're a poor nation or a developing nation, third, fourth, or fifth world, you don't have much of a chance to do that. Some other unjust economic structures. The military arms race. We will spend $300 billion for the arms race this year. That's all the nations in the world. $300 billion. Each man, woman, and child in the United States, through our taxes, pays $450 for our defense. According to the latest Quaker figures, or figures put out by the Quakers, we now have the ability to bomb and kill everybody in the world 11 times. You know, how much defense do we need? $450 goes for the arms race, the 5 B-1 bombers, the Trident submarines, all our missile systems. We put $6 for every man, woman, and child a year into economic aid for developing nations or for hungry people. I think it's something like $18 goes to education, $20 for housing. And when you compare that to $450 annually for each man, woman, and child, I think you can see that we cannot continue to build up our defenses and also feed or help hungry people. So the arms race is one thing. I also remind you that never in the history of the world have we developed arms that we have not used. And the Russian playwright that said, you know, if you hang a gun on the wall in the first act, you have to use it in the third act, and I think it's a very frightening thing. Other unjust economic structures. The third world has increased their export items by 30% in the last 20 years, but the amount of money that they receive for this 30% increase in what they are exporting only amounts to about 4%. So they're kind of, you know, taking a step backwards. This does not mean the oil-producing countries. I'm excluding them for that. In 1966, 25 tons of rubber that was exported from a South American country would in return buy 6 tractors from us. But because of inflation, that same amount of rubber buys only 2 tractors. So more land is therefore put into rubber because they have to export more rubber to get more money, and therefore less land is put into agricultural use, where 40% of the people are starving, as in Brazil. The same is true in Mexico. 40% of our winter vegetables, all the lettuce and the tomatoes and the things that we think are really neat when we have chef salad night, come from Mexico. 2 states in Mexico, in the northern part of Mexico, supply us with 40% of our winter vegetables. And therefore, they put more and more of the land in Mexico into this export agricultural product. And therefore, the people in Mexico are hungry. The peasants who do not own the land are literally starving because, again, we in America would like to have our tomatoes and our lettuce and our things that aren't necessarily in season. Sugar in Haiti. Most of the tillable land in Haiti, where starvation is probably more rampant than any place in the world, but land is put into sugar owned by American countries because we Americans like to have our sugar when we want it. The debt of the third world has doubled in 2 years. And because their debt has doubled, they put more and more of their land into crops that can be exported to rich nations. And again, people starve because they don't have enough in cultivation for their own needs. Trade practices impede industry in the third world. Our trade practices are really funny, and I don't fully understand them. I know we're making great strides, especially with India. But for an example, Ghana exports cocoa to Western Germany. And when they do, Western Germany puts a duty on that cocoa of 4%. If Ghana would make their cocoa into chocolate bars and sell it to West Germany, Germany puts a 12% export duty or import duty on that chocolate bar. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If you just sell the raw product, you don't have to pay as much to have it enter the country. But if you set up an industry and make chocolate bars, then you have to pay a lot more. So why develop a chocolate bar factory? You know, why have Hershey, Pennsylvania down in Ghana? Because Western Germany doesn't want, they would rather manufacture it and provide jobs for the chocolate bar in their own country. At least that's how I read this. 90% of banana profits from the South American countries go directly to Dole or the American firm or Chiquita Banana, whoever does it, and only 10% of those banana profits stay in the country. So again, if you think the trickle-down theory, which is supposed to work, works, I really think it does. The same way with our coffee prices. You know, I really get angry that I have to pay $3 a pound for coffee. And yet Bread for the World just put out a big spiel on, you know, is it really good to boycott coffee? Because if we boycott it, they're going to have a surplus of coffee, and the price is going to drop, and there's going to be less money going into that country. On the other hand, not much of that money really gets to the peasant who works on the coffee plantation. Most of it goes to the wealthy landowner, the wealthy plantation owner. So what you have is a great disparity, again, that's increasing all the time between the haves and the have-nots in the South American countries.
Mary, tell us what you mean by the trickle-down theory.
Well, supposedly more money that gets into a country than it goes into schools and roads and welfare programs for the peasant. And that really, you know, theoretically it ought to work, but such a small percentage of that money ever gets back to the peasant. And 40% of the people in Brazil are starving. They are really starving. So the trickle-down theory obviously isn't, you know, functioning like it's supposed to be. I think for a competitive market to really work, it is necessary that both of the parties have equal strength. It's just like when we had slaves, you know, or in the desegregation process. You had to have people that were both, at least had equal power, maybe not equal, but fairly nearly equal power. But now the affluence of the rich people really depend on the poverty or the poorness of the poor people. Until you can't really talk about a competitive market until you have nations that are rather equal in strength economically. Okay, all those things, I wouldn't pretend to understand them completely, but I think that a United Nations report did help me to see that, you know, it's not an easy problem. They also, in that UN report, I don't know whether this is hopeful or not, but I'm going to read it, that the gap in per capita production between the rich and the poor nations could be cut in half by the year 2000 if we would do three things. If we would give more aid to developing these countries, which I think means cutting down on our defense budget, if we would improve the price they get for their products, and if we would reduce dependence upon imports of manufactured goods. I remember flying to New York one day on an Eastern shuttle, and I happened to sit by a man who was very high up in the Indian government. I don't know what he was doing in tourist class, but he was sitting there. And we had an hour to talk, and I said, you know, just a casual little question, how can we in America help you Indians? First of all, he didn't think they really needed a lot of help, which was surprising to me. But he said, the main thing I think your government can do is to give us fair trade agreements. He said, we really could manufacture and do a lot of things in our country, but with the trade agreements are such, the import duties are such, that we really can't make much money when we sell them to your country. So I don't know what that says, but maybe there aren't a lot of things that we can do along that line. However, one of the big causes, I think, for hunger, besides unjust economic structures, the weather and the arms race and overpopulation, is something that we can do something about. And that's the overconsumption and waste of rich nations. So I'd like to talk about some things that maybe we can do today, and then I'd like to have you thinking about what Holden Village can do, even above and beyond what you already do. I think, first of all, we have to look to our eating habits. An American person, every man, woman, and child, the average, consumes 1,800 pounds of grain a year. This isn't in, you know, that you sit down and eat barley, bulgur, rice, or whatever it is in a bowl, but it goes for feeding cattle, okay. You've had a presentation, I think, Karin or somebody with Bread for the World, so probably these things aren't new to you. But the ratio of grain to, takes 10 pounds of grain to get a pound of beef, or 21 protein units to get 1 pound of protein unit in beef. The ratio, that's a very poor conversion rate, but we like our beef, and so we use a lot of grain to feed beef. The ratio is much better if you take pork. It's 4-1. If you take chicken, it's 2.5-1. And Meredith, what is it for trout? You told me the other day, didn't you?
Are you talking about protein or are you talking about...
Well, either one.
Well, amount of... A lot of warm water fish could be up to 1-1.
1-1. So maybe fish, if Meredith gets it going, we can supply Holden Village with fish. That would be really neat. But beef is about... What?
Pardon?
Eat fly.
Good. They have flies. Right. That's very nice. They can clear the mosquitoes and flies out. In other words, beef is to food like Cadillacs are to energy. You know, so we have to start looking. Can we live with a little bit more compact model? I think that's what Bread for the World is saying. Try to maybe use more trout, chicken, pork, and lay off the beef so much. And I'm just delighted to find Holden's meals the way they are. Our compliments to the chefs. They're really just wonderful. And I think it's a justice issue that we can address. And I'm very pleased. I hope nobody gripes about the food up here. Yeah. That's true. Our mountain farm is a very good example. We can't do anything on it because it's like this, except have cattle that have two legs shorter than the others to walk on it. If they're grass-fed cattle, I don't have anything against us eating grass-fed beef. And in fact, on the East Coast, Safeway now has two kinds of beef you can buy. You can ask for grass-fed beef, or you can have the marbled, tender, grain-fed beef. You know, I don't think... Well, we need cattle on our land for the very turf and the grass and the fertilization and everything. I mean, I think it's a very good way to use your land. I'm just saying that we don't have to take the available grain that we have and use 80% of it to feed cattle. And that's what Russia did with the grain that they bought. You know, they fed most of it to their cattle because the Russians like beef as much as we do. But it means that in India or Bangladesh or those third and fourth world countries, they don't feed it to their livestock, which is a very poor conversion ratio of how to get your protein. They eat it directly. So I heard Hubert Humphrey talk at a Lutheran Council meeting one time too, and he really felt that so much more of our grain could be used overseas and where it's needed if we didn't feed so much of it. In fact, he just said if everybody would cut out one McDonald's hamburger a week, we could probably feed all of Bangladesh with no problem at all. So, you know, I think that's right, that a lot of the ground can be used to graze animals. But why then stuff them in a feedlot and give them so much of our grain just because we don't like to have a little bit tougher grade of meat? So you can eat meat that isn't grain-fed. You can cut down on your meatless meals. I mean, cut down on the meat, have a lot of meatless meals. Know that when you mix wheat products with beans, you increase the protein value 33%. If you have a salad and you toss cheese or cottage cheese in it or something, you know, you're really getting a very good source of protein. We eat so much more protein than our body can absorb. It's literally just excreted. There is no way to use all the protein that we eat, so don't think you're not going to get the proper amount of food if you don't have meat every meal. Cut down on the junk foods. Goodness gracious. Potato chips take 20 times more energy from cutting and slicing and frying and packaging and getting them into the store so they're not crushed. 20 times more energy if you have potato chips than if you would just either bake, boil, or do anything to a potato. Even an hour in the oven doesn't take as much energy as eating potato chips. You know, until we just start saying, I'm not going to eat potato chips, I'm not going to eat Fritos, Cheetos, and all those other things that take so much energy, until you have a million St. Francis's that start this backward trend again, they're going to continue to produce potato chips. And before we came up to Holden, we heard the Select Senate Committee on Nutrition and Health. It was Percy, McGovern, Kennedy, Dole, four of them. They talked about what their committee had come up with, and one of the main things was that until Americans cut down 60 to 80% on the amount of sugar that they take, we're going to have a sick, heart-conditioned, that's not the word I want, there's going to be a lot of health problems. We never used to have the health problems that we do now, from the teeth to everything else in your body. 60 to 80%, now that's pretty radical. Again, Holden Village rarely has desserts, and I hope nobody complains about it. But raw sugar in the form of candy and soda pop. The only good thing I can tell you about West Virginia is that it's the first, oh, there are many good things, but they're usually behind in everything. But they were the first state to take out all the soda and ice cream machines and candy bar machines, and they have put in machines that...
In the schools.
Milk, popcorn, pretzels, apples, orange juice, yogurt, those kind of things are now in the vending machines. And the parents have been the first ones to complain. You know, the kids have kind of accepted it. The parents seem to think that their children are somehow deprived. But just, you know, think about these things as you look to your eating habits. When you have some meatless meals or fast one day a week or even one meal a week, have something on your table to remind you that you're going to take the money that you save and give it to Lutheran World Relief or CARE or Bread for the World. If you don't already know it, Lutheran World Relief has the best record, best track record of any group in the United States, religious or non-religious, it doesn't make any difference, for the percent of money that actually gets to help the hunger problem, whether they buy praying mantises and ladybugs, or whether they dig wells, or whether they give direct aid or build roads or have some way to store the grain or whatever, about 94% of the money that you send to Lutheran World Relief goes for direct aid. The staff is paid very, very little. All right, the other thing that I think we can do is, as far as direct, that would have some direct effect on hunger, is to work in the political arena. And here is my, to work in the political arena. You just can't say that because I don't eat hamburgers on Wednesday, that that hamburger or that grain is automatically going to get over to help where it's needed. The only way this happens is through political changes. Last year, through efforts of Bread for the World, there was the Right to Food resolution that was passed unanimously by both houses of Congress. This resolution simply stated that every person in the world had a right to food and that the United States was going to do what they could to see that this happened. In 1974, Kissinger went to the Rome Food Conference and pledged America's support to end hunger in the world within 10 years. Now that was 74 and this is 77 and virtually nothing has been done so far. We pledged in the United Nations that we would do everything we could to set up a world food reserve. And that's the big push for Bread for the World this year. A world food reserve simply means that whereas we used to have 90 days of food reserves to help in time of crisis or famine, we now have about 12 days worldwide, 12 days of extra food left if something would happen. A world food reserve should be set up according to the United Nations, and we pledge to help in this, and Bread for the World is really pushing it. It means that this year and last year were very good years for the American farmer and for many places in the world. We now have a large grain surplus, and of course the price of wheat has dropped. Now would be a good time to buy this wheat from the farmers to store it. And as there is, it would help the boom-bust cycle. If there is a poor year for grain, then you put some of this out on the market. If there is a famine, or if India or Bangladesh or any other country has monsoons or droughts, they're able to buy it at normal, not inflated, but very normal prices. It would mean that food wouldn't be used as a weapon. 80% of our aid that we gave in the last 2 years to nations went to those countries that we wanted to make sure remained our friends, like Thailand and Korea and Vietnam and places like that. They did not go to the most seriously affected nations. So we use our food and our aid as a political weapon, and this would ensure that this wouldn't happen. So I urge you to join Bread for the World. I know that the Fullness of God Church has joined as a congregation. Bread for the World is not a direct aid group. It is an ecumenical group made up of many church groups in the United States. Its director is Art Simon, who is a Missouri Synod pastor. His brother is Paul Simon, senator from Illinois. He lives on $8,000 a year. His secretary, who has a family that she supports, makes more than he does. The salaries in Bread for the World are very equally divided as to needs, so you don't have to be afraid that any money you would send to Bread for the World goes to simply pay staff. You join Bread for the World by sending in $10. That $10 goes mainly for lobbying efforts, and that's what Bread for the World is all about. They lobby up on Capitol Hill, and they try to see that any bill that comes up that relates to hunger or world food distribution is addressed. And they were responsible for getting the Right to Food resolution passed last year. They got 240,000 letters from people throughout the United States up on Capitol Hill. And senators have said, and congressmen, that this is the most mail that has ever been received on any issue. 240,000 letters. Letters really do make a difference. I can remember Gene McCarthy telling us one time that when we were working very hard on the welfare reform bill in the late 60s, he got two letters from you Minnesota people that are here about this bill. And he said, obviously the people aren't very excited about it. Why should I knock myself out to see that there is any welfare reform bill passed? Every time, if you haven't written to your congressman or your senator, believe me, they will write back. And if you write an intelligent letter, they are very grateful for that. Congressman Foley from the Spokane District really relies on Bread for the World constituents to inform him about what's going on. Don't think that our congressmen or senators are miracle men. They hire a big staff to do research, and they can't possibly keep up on everything that's going on. And if you can keep yourself informed about hunger problems and write and say, look, I really am concerned about the World Food Reserve. I'd like to see that our farmers get a fair deal and that we have ways to stockpile everything from soup to nuts. We have copper and tin, and everything is controlled except food. And that's our main thing that we need for life. John tells me that the mafia is even in on the food agribusiness now. They even have a group of food stores in the East called Tops, where it's now controlled by the mafia. You know, why let the mafia control our food? It's simply because we're not very interested or don't think it's very important, because we always seem to have enough food on the table. Letters do make a big difference, and Bread for the World only functions if people like you and I write letters. And Fullness of God will do absolutely nothing toward changing some of the food policies if each of you who belong to Fullness of God don't write your senator. I don't know who the congressman is from this district. Mike McCormick. He has an excellent record on food legislation. So if you write to Mike McCormick, thank him for his votes in the past, but just say, here's another person that is very concerned. Scoop Jackson and who's the other? Magnuson? Both have fairly decent records on hunger too. But especially Jackson needs a little bit of prodding, because he's very high on defense spending, as you all know. So if you want to write him a letter, you might say that I don't think we can feed and, you know, have the kind of defense budget that we have.
What is Foley's attitude? He's the chairman of the Agriculture Committee.
Yes, he's good. A Bread for the World supporter. So Washington has just marvelous people when it comes to food things, food problems, and food legislation. So the only thing that your $10 does, besides let Bread for the World know that you're interested, is to get you a monthly newsletter. And it's very easy to understand. It gives you all the information that you need about the upcoming bills. They'll send you all the information about the World Food Reserve Program so that you can write an intelligent letter to your senator or congressman. And it also just is kind of encouraging to those people who work day and night in their lobbying efforts. So I'm going to put these out or pass them around. If anybody wants to join Bread for the World as an individual, I wish you would. There's a little thing. Fill in this blank, send a $10 check, and just know that it won't work unless you write letters. And don't think that, you know, that you're not smart enough or knowledgeable enough to write. Even if you send a 10-word telegram that says, get on the ball and get us a World Food Reserve Program, love, Mary, or whatever, you know, that's important. For $1, you can send a, what is it, Teresa?
A mailogram
that has the impact of a telegram, right? Isn't that what the ad said? Or if you're ever in D.C. or if you're in the district where your congressman lives and he's home, a lot of Bread for the World groups meet monthly and they go down and make an appointment to talk with their congressman. I just can't impress on you how important letters are.
Elise and I talked a little bit about it. The Bread for the World film strip indicates that church people last year were very generous with their donations of money. It was $22 million for World Hunger. That really is and they commended us for it. In one vote one day in a committee in Congress, over $200 million was cut out of foreign aid by one committee's vote. And the point was, whereas we were very generous in one regard with our stewardship of money, we were very negligent in our stewardship of citizenship, of saying how we felt about priorities, and we really were wiped out 10 times what we had given in our sacrificial offering of money by not stating what we desired in foreign aid. And I think that's kind of saying it dramatically, and that's the one piece that Bread for the World is most interested in, is that public era, making our views known.
So I would just close by, you know, saying that the miracle of how the people were fed in the New Testament, I don't know how that worked, whether Jesus took a loaf of bread and it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, or the fish kept growing and growing or whatever, but I think Malcolm Muggeridge makes a beautiful point that might have been a miracle, and maybe that's how it was. But what more of a miracle would it have been if everyone would have done what that small boy did and just shared what they had? And I think for me that's the miracle too, that when we sense that our family is suffering and are willing to share what we have, to do without, to give some money where it's needed, to write letters, to be really concerned people, that would be much more of a miracle to me than having a giant loaf of bread or something, whatever happened. I wondered if you could just think, I mean, I thought of some things as I was writing this morning about things that Holden might do. You're just in such a beautiful position up here, especially in the summer when you have thousands of people coming through all summer long to really make a big impact. And these people come from all over the United States, or at least from Minnesota. couple of other states. And to so that they would take this message back home. I think one thing they're going to see is your meals, if they continue to be like they are.
Except that I think that maybe in just a quiet way somewhere in the village, something should be said about maybe a policy of our meals. I mean, some people will just get the idea, well, Holden's just too cheap to service,
mm-hmm.
you know, or we're just too... I think maybe, I don't know just how that should be, but so a point was made of the fact that tonight we're having lentil stew, which is a very good high-protein meatless meal, and the reason why we're doing it, not without flaunting it and making announcements about it, that gets to be kind of, but maybe some of you would have some ideas about maybe a little... Maybe we could print up just a little pamphlet and have it kind of pick up table somewhere. Or even possibly, Karen, it could be put on the bulletin board outside during the summer where the men are, you know, just a little bit like the day's activities are, and you could put,
of course,
like for supper.
Yeah.
A little tab.
Yeah.
And then, you know, possibly a reason why. Yeah.
I was thinking, and we are going to, I think, are you still working on cookbook, excuse me?
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing can be put in our cookbook too. Of course, we do have Diet for a Small Planet in those books.
Well, I think that's a really good point, because it took, I think I was here for at least a month, if not 2 months, before I even noticed that we ever had meatless meals. Meatless days. I mean, it just, I ate what was there. It was good. I didn't notice that the lunches just had meat in it.
Just a comment about what Karen said. Don't think if you're changing your eating habits that you're going to get by with less money, because cheese and nuts and all the good things in Diet for a Small Planet and Recipes for a Small Planet and a lot of these books, you cannot change your eating habits and think that meat is the most expensive thing. It just isn't. You do not save any money, but boy, is it better for you and for the world. Okay, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to suggest maybe with the literature and stuff that you pass out when everyone comes, that there could be some little thing explaining about the food and why we have what we have. Then everyone would get it when they came into the village.
Anybody else have any ideas that could happen?
There could be discussions too when we're hungry.
I think there will be some next summer. Isn't Evelyn Strang going to do some of that, Karen? Do you know what she wrote to Marlene?
Enough is enough.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll do that. And we've always had discussions on that.
Yeah.
Every summer. Somebody does. Leo does it. Al Pitcher. There's always some emphasis on that.
Do you have a potato day in the summer for a meal?
No.
And I'm not sure that we can in the summer.
Yeah.
Well,
if everyone came here for a week and just stayed for a week, you know, for a program week, then it would be neat.
But some people come for 1 day or 2 days.
Yeah,
or
so many people come for just overnight or 2 days.
Well, if you ever did or something, there I've seen where you can just make a little tiny blurb about hunger and just have them on each table for people to read, you know, during the meal. Or another thing that a lot of churches have done, of course this is at a workshop and maybe you've been in on it, is to have around the table different colored placemats. You know, there's 2 red placemats and 4 green and 4 blue or and 1 white or something, and if you happen to sit at the red one, you don't know what color is what each time. You get a full ham dinner with potatoes and gravy and everything and a salad. If you sit at the 4 blue ones, you get maybe potatoes with some cooked cabbage on top and maybe one little piece of carrot to give it color. If you sit at the 4 green ones, you get just a bowl of broth and nothing to drink. You know, that's very effective. But it's, you know, it really lays it out. And I know the first one John was at Faith Church in Arlington, Virginia, he was a speaker, and he got one of the red placemats and got the full meal. And the other man at the same table who also got the full meal literally could not eat his food when he sat there and saw other people with just a bowl of broth or a little bit of potato with a cabbage. It's very hard to sit and eat your fill of all these salads and desserts, etc., when literally people sitting around you are hungry. Or at least they're certainly looking drooling. But I think, you know, that kind of a meal once in a while up here, if you could pull it off, maybe have a hunger day or just, and then put those out at the meals at night and explain to people what they're doing. If they have dietary problems or small children, maybe you can make sure that they get enough to eat or have the right food. But those kinds of things would be an idea. And maybe a bulletin board that is just nothing but Bread for the World information, Lutheran World Relief, hunger articles, pictures that are changed often. It helps to keep it in front of people because it's very easy just to think about it for a day and, oh well, you know, it's around me, why should I not take advantage of it? Again, to me it's a solidarity with and to kind of understand the sufferings of others.
I think one of the things that has changed the atmosphere at the seminary I went to is that they now have 7 or 8 third and fourth world seminarians as part of the community. I really think that's another way. I don't know if Holden ever has either faculty or staff from third and fourth world nations, but I think that's one of the ways that you become part of a global family, is really to have them as part of your intimate family for a while. Elise had her hand up. I don't know if she's...
I was thinking about that article that you mentioned several days ago, the deprivation of primary children.
Creative deprivation?
Yeah. And I was thinking that it came up again, I think, when we spoke to that, and how that's not really deprivation at all. And in this sense, too, that rather than feel like we're getting, you know, good marks for extra effort and kind of loving Christians in this sense, then it's also part of the celebration of the kingdom to share each other's burdens. We live in an inverted universe as Christians, and that's part of the inversion.
Right.
And that sense of being being able to join someone else in their lives, whether it's a particular nature of their deprivation that we share as part of our celebration, or vice versa. I mean, we may be able to find some ways to raise in some sort of direct exchange, raise the level of poverty, even if it's still within poverty, a certain joy is available to you above the range of this, the child of the dark.
You
know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. We don't do it out of some kind of really stir up everybody's guilt now and one more. Guilt is there for a purpose. I think we're not against understanding that we have guilt, but that we can act on it on something for another reason.
Just the idea of celebration too, of, you know, food never tastes so good as when you fasted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, again, at Christmas time, we just have so much we really don't appreciate it or celebrate it.
Mm-hmm. Food. The absence makes the heart grow larger.
Food is one of the places that you really can make the major emphasis that we will be healthier.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the changes, and you point to Americans' problems of obesity, too much cholesterol, the 60% we ought to cut down in raw sugar, the junk food, the chemical and the additives. The doctor, after he retired at age 70 or something and working with hyperactive children, and is trying, and everyone is not that successful, but the percentage of success is very high. The only thing is he cuts out all chemical and additives, and he puts them on a natural food diet. And some of those kids are sitting in a class within 3 weeks. I think you can really stress the fact that we're not eating well. We're eating a lot and too much. And sometimes I think lifestyle changes, and we've said that a couple times, start mostly out of guilt and end in deprivation, instead of starting out of either a sense of the kingdom or of us really being freed. The wilderness was a form of freedom. But you really want to go back to some of the slavery. The quails coming out of our noses is not an exaggerated picture of us eating in the United States. It's part of our slavery. Karen the other day perked up on the business of, it's a lot of small things that have brought us to where we are, and some of the individual steps that we take are part of the answer. And I guess Mary and I are hopeful that the small steps, and I'm not sure that any great thing ever comes from being with people. Certainly I have my ideas it does not come from being with a group for 1 hour one night and misunderstanding much of what we try to say. I feel a little better when we're with a group for a week. But I try to keep in my mind that for some of the changes, and even for my own moving out into freedom, I keep in mind a story I overheard. Two little girls in the community of Christ playing. Chrissy is 6 and Rachel is 5. And they were playing as kids play, and I enjoyed listening to the conversation but wasn't paying much attention until Chrissy said, "Let's be blood sisters." And Rachel said, "Great." And I could tell Rachel didn't have any idea what that meant. So Chrissy went over, there was a chalkboard and some chalk, and she went over and got a little bit of red chalk, red or orange, and put it on her wrist. Then she went over to Rachel and she rubbed some of it, so they both had some red chalk, and she said to Rachel, "Now we're blood sisters." And Rachel said, "Great." And there was a long pause, and Chrissy said, "That cutting part, we'll wait till we're 10. So if we're going to start, let's get at the cutting part right. That's the only way you get to be blood sisters.
There are, I think what we're getting at is the other end of deprivation is the joy it is to kind of cut loose some things. I've heard a couple of illustrations in that regard. Somebody, well, even some of us here in the village have tried occasionally to diet and to cut down on food and stuff. And what a really good feeling that gives after you get through the initial withdrawal. I think Marlene was commenting the other day on how much more energy she felt. And I suppose that physiologically it's true that some of the energy that we get from our food goes into the process of digesting the food. I mean, beyond what we need just for our own movement. Or somebody has illustrated it by saying if you go into a supermarket sometime and it's not terribly crowded so that you don't look terrible, doing this, pick up 10 pounds of hamburger and just kind of distribute it roughly around your... And a lady, one of our friends, said she tried doing that once. And she said how terrible it felt. You just felt so sagged and soggy all over. But she says that's what it is. I mean, you're carrying 10 pounds extra weight. And if you do that voluntarily, how ugly it feels. And all of a sudden, don't get caught doing it, I guess. But another thing that we felt too, and probably a lot of people at Holden have this experience, we had to move, of course, in order to get here, and we had to store our stuff. And if there's ever a time when we would have liked to have done some really creative depriving, that was it. Yeah. Hauling all of that garbage and plunder of accumulation of 9 years and wondering at what point it really was all that necessary to possess and accumulate all that junk. And what a burden it becomes, and even becomes a burden from appreciating things we have, because time and again, you probably had this experience too, you come into something and say, you know, I never realized I even had that, because it was so far down in the archaeological layers of things in the house that you might as well not have it, because it's doing no good, and just being inundated by the sheer quantity of junk.
What is the meal tonight? Oh, the potato day or the barley day doesn't mean it's barley again? Okay, I was just going to say something
else.
It's fish. Okay, that's good.
This has nothing to do with hunger, but I don't know, I've been doing so much reading lately on how the United States spends money and so forth. We are putting billions of dollars into cancer research, which is a disease of affluent Western man, and millions of dollars, I don't know how many millions, into kidney transplants, you know, that give maybe 5,000 people a year a little bit extra life. And yet there are 12 million lepers in the world. You know, half of the kids in Africa are going to die of malaria. And all of these parasitic diseases that the world is just paying no attention to. In some place I read, they said if the fly that carried filariasis, which causes elephantiasis, you know, this gigantic legs and scrotum and so forth, if and river blindness, all in this disease, if that fly was along the Colorado River instead of along, you know, some river in Africa, boy, it would take about a year before that would be eliminated. And they're sure now that they can have a vaccine for malaria, which will be much cheaper and easier than trying to get rid of all the mosquitoes and for a lot of these parasitic diseases. And yet, you know, because we don't see it, we just don't, I think National Institute of Health budgeted $1 million last year for leprosy and malaria research, you know, which is just nothing compared to the billions that they spend on cancer. But I don't know. That's.
Did you say one third of the entire deaths yearly is
due to
starvation?
Malnutrition,
hunger-related
diseases.
And then the number one killer, is this correct in the United States, is heart disease? Isn't that right?
I think so.
I think so.
Yeah. Due to our diet, basically.
Basically.
Pressure and illness.
A couple things, Jeffrey, from what you said. One, that when the Vietnam War was highly televised, I mean, relatively highly, we had a war in our living room for years, say. And the callousness that developed without very much time at all for most people, I think, in terms of watching that. And that sense of being there for something that isn't available once hit, I mean, as an immediate physical experience for us, it seems to me that the contemplative life or the life in prayer is almost the only way you get eyes to see and ears to hear again and recognize what that means. Because statistics can't carry a human being with them, not one single human being very well.
Yeah.
And so the kind of exposure that even if we had a mass, you know, I remember in the middle of a shopping center, John wrote this poem about somebody being hit by napalm after we ran into this. It was after several years of the war, and it wasn't the first time we'd seen pictures of it or anything, but it was in an exhibit in the middle of a shopping center. And I think it was the incongruity of having to look at it there, where there was no kind of preparation, that really hit. Maybe if there were some things in the supermarkets, you know, it might really hit me my daily bread, whatever. And I don't know what the other thing was. But that really is a fear I have of our ability to turn it off somewhere so that it doesn't affect me anymore. I mean, I don't respond with my whole, even. We seem to have a terrific survival instinct.
Yeah. The
at that level. And if it's going to infringe on my comfort and my sense of being able to live with what I have, I can't stand it.
The major thrust of violence in America as whether or not TV violence is harmful. The psychologists and psychiatrists argue about whether or not the fact that our children by the time they're five have seen 13,000 murders, I guess that's about what it is now, or deaths on TV, about whether or not that causes violence. That's debatable. The thing that they say is the danger is that we become immune and can then live in the real world and see real violence and not even be shocked anymore. That was the thing that, and so C.P. Snow said, we will, by the end of the 1970s, be watching people starve on our TV sets. And I think your point is that doesn't necessarily mean all of America or all the U.S. would wake up and have compassion. I think we'd get immune again by seeing it.
In fact, I know the other thing that I think an argument against helping people in certain situations in this world has been, well, you're just keeping them alive to suffer more later.
Yeah.
You know, in that sense of they're growing into a society that doesn't have much for them, or there's going to be more hunger, more disease. And that idea that we seem to run on progress and productivity, this book about Mother Teresa has really sunk deep in me, and I just keep thinking and seeing that reversal too, where instead of, don't ask if it, you know, what difference it makes worldwide. That isn't the point of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a human being.
Well, here's Bread for the World brochures, if any of you have been so moved. I'll leave them up here. If you don't have $10, take one anyway and just write and tell them when you have $10. Maybe you'll contribute something, but you'd like to be on their mailing list, and I imagine they'll just let you be. They also send you a book called Bread for the World, and it's excellent, a very concise, not very large paperback on hunger problems.
In the bookstore and in the library. Bread for the World.
Good.
Thank you.